planned for this evening. I thought we would start with kind of a brief introduction to a practice that we will do again in the days to come. Spend 10 minutes or so with it, and then go back into a discussion of this chapter. I think we can probably finish it. And then do a practice, which I will talk about when the time comes. So that's our schedule. So the introduction is to a practice that Bruce actually mentioned, called Marriage of Sound and Breath. And in the first TSK book, where you find Going Without Going, that's exercise 23. Marriage of Sound and Breath is exercise 24. So there is a kind of a, I wouldn't say a progression, but let's say the two have a kind of a linkage to it. So the practice is simple. You can do it on a cushion or on a chair, whichever you prefer. Hybrids that we have there. So we focus on the breath and just let it flow without trying to do anything special with the breath. And as you tune in to breathing, then also become aware of the sounds around you. And if you find it easier, you can do this in the opposite direction. Start off with the sounds, and then become more attuned to the breathing. And the key to the practice is that you don't do one and then the other, or sometimes one and sometimes the other. The idea is to cultivate an awareness of both those things at once, the sound and the breath. And they come together in the throat. So your focus is on the throat. So you could say, although this is a much too technological way of saying this, you could say there's three things that you're focused on. The throat, the breath, and sounds, and any sounds, internal, external, whatever they are. But the idea really is to let the separation, you know, the different spheres of activity, let go of that. Let sound and breath come together in the throat. So, marriage of sound and breath. So we'll do that, and this is just a little introduction, and so we'll do it for about 10 minutes. Okay? is not there. And we'll launch right into the chapter, see if we can finish it. So we have this basic distinction we've been making between the subjective and the objective realms, between knowledge, technological knowledge, and desire. Between the subjective self and the objective world. So, page 36, in the section called Knowledge Without Power, with knowledge confined in this way, the self finds itself situated in a world given in advance. The role of cognition is to describe or make use of this given world. For the most part, this will take place through thinking, as knowledge offers models of what is real and true. Notice one of the things I'm sure you've noticed in reading Love of Knowledge, and if you haven't looked at it before, you've probably struck you now. So many words are inside scare quotes, right?
Inside
what? Scare quotes, single quotes, that's what they're, they're kind of like as if quotes. Like, we use the word, but we want you to kind of pay attention to the word, but we're not using it in the usual way. Okay. So knowledge offers models of what is real and true. So this is technological knowledge we're talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the basic idea here is that thinking is aligned with that kind of knowledge. So if there were a knowledge that had to do with, let's say, feeling or sensing, it might not line up with technological knowledge in quite the same way. But would it really be knowledge? If you're following the technological model for knowledge, if you're talking about technological model knowledge, then it's hard to say that it would be. But just, we don't think of knowledge as coming through feeling. We'll say, I had this hunch, this intuitive feeling. We try to bridge the gap. But in fact, in trying to bridge it, we confirm that it's there. We say, well, that's not our usual way of understanding knowledge. Okay, there's something there. Okay, but the usual approach, for the most part, as he says, this will take place, cognition will take place, really, through thinking, as knowledge offers models of what is real and true. Certain information is provided, a certain logic is worked out, and then a rule is established. Following thinking's lead means conforming to this rule or model. Once knowledge is identified with the structures established by thought, it becomes a second-class citizen in the self's subjective world, wholly subordinate to the structures of desire. Unlike desire, in which the momentum that leads toward action is intrinsic to the desire itself, thinking lacks the energy that flows directly into doing. Encoded in the rules and interpretations imposed by thought as a way of linking subjective and objective, knowing loses its intimate connection to being. This is another one of these paragraph-ending sentences that's very powerful, right? Knowing loses its intimate connection to being. There's this back and forth here. You can say in the objective world, the self, as we've been saying kind of casually, but I think it's helpful, the self is like a black hole. It doesn't show up in that world, right? And what goes on inside the self is mysterious. And, you know, hard science tends to ignore it completely and say, well, that either you can reduce it to objective facts, kind of like primary qualities, or it's just not real, it's just something we make up. But that answer, that way of looking at what the self is, discounts it, but it leaves the self intact, because we know that we're the most important thing there is, right? We're very clear about that. So the fact that science doesn't agree, means we just have to compartmentalize our thinking, kind of, and say, when we're talking scientifically, it makes sense to talk in a certain way, but in terms of our experience, the self is absolutely real. And now, this paragraph has just switched over to that perspective, you could say. And say, from a subjective point of view, knowledge is very useful, technological knowledge, but it's as he says here, it's a second class citizen, right? Because what really counts is what I want and how to go about getting it. And knowledge is a tool to help me get what I want. And either it's a good tool, it's a bad tool, it works or it doesn't work. It doesn't have any ultimate significance, you could say, in itself. And the reason is because we understand knowledge in a certain way, in this way that we've talked about here. You know? There's a model, there's a logic, there's information, all of that stuff is useful, but it doesn't have the juice that our real experience has, that our desires have. It's kind of, what's the word? It's kind of palate. I mean, that's a good word, but it's not one we use much. It's kind of ghost-like, you know. It doesn't engage us. And that's one of the reasons that, people who say, well, and say very sincerely, they say, well, I'm interested in experience. I'm not interested in information. I'm not interested in concepts and constructs. What they're saying is, in part anyway, that all of that stuff is kind of, dead. It doesn't have any power. It can't really make anything happen. And Rinpoche is saying in this chapter, that's absolutely right. It's because the part that's alive for us is our subjective experience, and then knowledge is just this tool that gets added in. The problem, of course, with that way of looking at it is that we can't say, well, I don't care about conceptual structures, because we use them. And in using them, we are in fact shaped by them, and our experience is shaped by them. It's not as though we say, well, I'll just stay with pure experience and don't talk to me about your theories, because we are always already applying theories. We already have, as he says here, a pre-existing world which has been put together by knowledge. So we come in kind of too late, we've already bought in to a particular understanding, and now we say, well, I don't want any more concepts or theories, or I don't want concepts or theories at all, when in fact everything that we experience is shaped by concepts and theories. But the only kind of knowledge that we have access to, because that world that we've shaped that theoretical world, it's already there. And it's kind of like we're born into it, you know. It's not really true that we're born into it, but we're raised into it, you know. And it changes over time as we're growing up, and, you know, new ideas get introduced, and new understandings get introduced. But it's always kind of the environment for us. And then the knowledge that we have available, which is shaped, is limited by all of that, can't really do anything. It's because it already operates within that set of structures. And as he says here, and that's started off with his last phrase, knowing loses its intimate connection to being. You can say, well, being is constructed by knowing, but not our knowing, not the knowing that we have access to, because our knowing only operates on the basis of these of thoughts, structures, concepts, and so on. And that undermines the power of knowledge, which goes back to what we were talking about earlier today, which is that knowledge becomes something kind of negative. It's like it's just this tool. We don't acknowledge its power to shape the world because we don't have access to that power. Okay. Divorced from penetrating intelligence and direct experience alike, because those are the two possibilities, right? You can say, okay, knowledge is not experience, but if we could bring to it a kind of an intelligence that looked in a fresh way at what was going on, then it could lead us back into experience. But that doesn't happen, because we've already bought into these structures. Right? So,
sometimes it happens, though.
Yes, right.
Sometimes it does happen in spurts.
Yeah, no, right. I mean, you know, all of this is kind of our characteristic way of being. Sometimes a miracle happens, you know.
Well, we can be inspired by knowledge in different ways, in new ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right.
It doesn't happen often.
Right. So part of, you know, it's kind of like what we were saying earlier today about, you know, these experiences that we seek out that put us more in touch with, you know, with our own being, our own aliveness. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen all that often either, so we seek them out. And in the same way, I mean, for some people, knowledge, the experience of knowing can be that kind of enlivening experience.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it does happen for most, you know, it happens for people sometimes. You know. This is just a story that comes to mind. My wife told me once that she was, I can't remember, I think she said about 7 years old. She remembers very clearly she was riding in the bus on the way to school, and suddenly this thought struck her, and she just asked herself, why is there something instead of nothing? And that was a moment of coming alive, you know, of knowledge really meaning something. And I think it tends to happen, you know, not for everybody and not very often, but it happens to people when they go off to college or university sometimes. You know, there's like they're exposed to completely mm-hmm. new ideas. And for a while, knowledge is really alive and it's tremendously stimulating and exciting. And then that, for most people, stops. Or they lose the aliveness of it, or as he said here, knowing loses its intimate connection to being. So yeah, sometimes it happens. So, you know, a question to ask is how could we activate that more?
Yes.
That's not, you know, the whole aim of what we're doing here, but it would be very nice. It would be very valuable. It would be really valuable. Right? To re-establish the intimate connection between knowing and being. That would be really.
Well, Rinpoche also talks about, through his books, that the knowledge can be opened up,
mm-hmm.
and we can touch that what's alive in it.
Right. Okay, well, this is a good point to make a kind of a good moment to make a kind of a fundamental point here. I think, you know, what are we looking at here? Because our theme, after all, is the self in question. Right? So the self has access to a certain kind of knowledge. What we're exploring right now, what we're talking about, is the kind of knowledge that's characteristic of the self. If you want to call that into question, if you want to go beyond that characteristic knowledge, if you want to awaken this intimate connection between knowing and being, that happens by calling the self and its world, I'm going to extend that a little bit now, calling the self and its world into question. And the way you do that is, as many kind of specific things you can do, and these TSK books are just full of great suggestions, you know. But if you want the kind of theme, the big theme, then that takes you exactly to the time-space knowledge vision, because you say the way, the time that the self proclaims and relies on and finds itself in is only one kind of time. It's a self-centered time. And the space that the self proclaims and inhabits is only one kind of space. It's a self-centered way of understanding space. And if you can open space, and one way to say that we've talked about is if you can make it more spacious. Mm-hmm. Another way to say it is if you can make it more accommodating and allowing. There are many ways to say it. Then, in that very act, the self becomes... the self is called into question. The self, when you call the self space into question, that's the same as calling the self into question. When you call the self's time into question, that's the same as calling the self into question. And when you do that, and to the extent that you do it, and you know, even if you just have little glimmers, you know, you're doing the going without going practice, mm-hmm. and there's a kind of a richness, sort of, or you know, some of the things people we're talking about this afternoon, something shifts, and to some degree, you could say, the connection between knowing and being is restored. And we find ourselves at home in the world, you know, in a very fundamental way. But to do that, you really need to call the self and its way of being in the world, its time and its space, into question. So, other ways to say that, you know, he says here, what happens is our usual knowledge is divorced from penetrating intelligence and from direct experience. And on the previous page at the top, he talked about we subordinate awareness, concentration, and active intelligence to the push and pull of wants, fears, and needs. That's our world. That's, you know, that's where we kind of wake up and find ourselves. You know, and the waking up part is very important. Recognizing that that's what's going on is very important. Now you're in a position to do something about it. So that's where we're kind of working, you could say. Okay. So he's going to make another somewhat specific point here. We're at the bottom of page 36. Knowledge based on thinking and models may gain substantial influence despite its flaws. And this is going to be one of these places where he kind of characterizes our present culture, you could say. The consequences can be deeply destructive across a broad reach of space and time, since it is subject to manipulation by the dominant force of desire and emotions. Such knowledge is readily transformed into belief, rationale, or ideology, lending a cloak of intellectual respectability to patterns of action based on desire and need. So that is very much our situation. You know, on the one hand, we have desires and needs and wants, and they're strong and powerful, and they drive our world, but there's no knowledge. And you know, at the best, there's a kind of a knowledge which turns into, as he says here, beliefs, rationales, ideology, you know, you could say prejudices, you could say, those are the words that come to my mind right now. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, you have knowledge, but it's a knowledge that's been stripped of its intimate connection to being. Mm-hmm. All that's kind of fed into the wanting side, the desiring side. That's where the power and the juice is. So that knowledge in itself is not fulfilling. Right? And it leaves us, you know, with very few options. We can't think our way out of our problems, because this whole structure that turns knowledge into something that's shaped by thoughts is the problem. You know, so if you try to think your way through, try to think your way clear, you can't. We can't just rely on pure experience, because then we fall into the other side, which is the wanting, desiring, wishing, which distorts our experience. So we need to recreate that marriage. Because the marriage of sound and breath exercise does kind of fit. Okay. When new knowledge does arise, it is understood as being bound to the objective realm, which is not the realm of the self. Thus, such knowledge does not directly affect the self in its being. Though conceptual models, new scientific theories, or new ideologies may seem inspiring, the response they evoke fails to bridge the gap between the being of the self and the being of the world that the self somehow inhabits. And it strikes me, this is not something I've thought through, but it strikes me that what I said before about people go off to college and you know, there are these new ideas mm-hmm. that are very exciting. But I think there is the tendency is, you know, one of the reasons they're really exciting is they seem to kind of make sense out of the world in this new objective way. It's not as though we have profound insight into our own nature. It's that suddenly we've figured it out, or someone has figured it out for us, you know, and we buy into it. We say, this is the way it is. So we've got this objective theory, and that's exciting. I mean, knowledge is really can be very inspiring in itself, even if it takes this kind of limited form. So people get excited. But as he says here, it doesn't touch the self, it does not directly affect the self in its being. The direct consequence of this pattern is that the impact of even the most powerful insights quickly fades. And now, you know, we're no longer talking about the 18-year-old who's excited about something, we're talking about all of us. And I think something that, you know, is always an issue, just, you know, just as much an issue when you're studying the TSK vision as anything else. Something, you have a certain experience and it's really powerful, it's really meaningful, and it doesn't last. So what is that? What is the not lasting? It's that it hasn't affected the self in its being. And that's one reason why I think it does make sense to say that you know, the TSK vision offers something really special, because it's saying you've got to transform the self in its own being, and then it offers the vehicle of time and space and new perspectives or new approaches, whatever you want to say, to time and space as a way of doing that. You've got to touch the self in its being, and you've got to do that in a way that activates new knowledge.
is that self, I mean, should you put that self in those little quotation marks there? Because we don't want the self as we live it.
Right. I'm kind of thinking about the very specific question you asked me. Why doesn't he put self in quotation marks since he puts every other word in quotation marks, it seems, right? And I'm not quite sure, but
yeah, Jim, why didn't you suggest that, Dave?
You know, it's actually and it's been a long time since I worked on this book, but Rinpoche, you know, he dictates his books, and then so it's an oral process, and you read it back to him. He's not the one putting in quotes, except with his words, you know, except with the way except the way he says it. So I always worry about that a little bit. You know, are there scare quotes in the right place? You know, that's the end of the side. That's not too interesting or important.
Jim, it seems to me that even when the self is touched, you can go through this beginning process or come up against some kind of resistance. I mean, even if you get really amazed at your experience, you completely forget it over and, I mean, even if you
right.
do that, it's small bits over and over. You can
right.
completely.
Well, I think that's true, and I think that's actually what's being said here is that even if you do touch knowledge that is transformative, it winds up being pulled back into this structure in which the self is this is this black hole. And there's objective reality, and the two just don't communicate with each other.
Was that because of habits?
It's because we don't know any better, and that I'm putting in scare quotes. You know, we don't know any better way to do it. We only have this way of knowing.
Well, isn't that what happened to Buddha? Though,
isn't
he didn't go back?
Right. That's right. And. You know, not to, I mean, I don't want to focus so much on the Buddha, because, that's not Buddhism. But in general, that is what happens to people when their lives are transformed by a certain way of knowing it. And it's a little hard to say how do you think about that? You know, let's say you had an experience. Sometimes people, in this kind of a setting, people who are attracted to this kind of inquiry and questioning, we'll say, I had an experience when I was 20 years old or something, and it really changed everything. And that seems right. But are they still living that experience?
Sure. Because I've had plenty of experiences.
Right.
But, to live, a friend of mine says it's hard to live life wonderfully all the time. It's very difficult. And like you said, it's because we don't know any better. We're working from a structure.
We do know better. And we don't do what we know to be better.
Well, that's an interesting question, too.
Yeah.
But if we're working from a model of knowledge that won't allow us to do any better, then we are trapped in that structure. And it's hard to break free of that structure because it is so conditioned in us from birth and it's so habitual.
So it's the desire part that overwhelms the knowing part.
When you say we know better but we don't act on what we know, that's another way of saying what he said in the little phrase, knowing has lost its intimate connection to being. So then you need to ask, so what's going on?
John,
yeah.
It seems that, at least in Buddhism,
there is a structure explaining, okay, for this is concept of karma, kalesha. So there is a way we could say, okay, how one will get there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping to find out, does TSK vision propose, or what is the way to get there? I mean, we do have glimpses, we have experiences,
mm-hmm.
and it's not stabilizing. And I mm-hmm. heard you at least once saying the first evening, the first hour I was here, that I wished it could stabilize. You said something, well, that's why you got to practice more. Would you hold that ground? I mean, is it through practice? Because it seems to, in Buddhism, it is certain practices,
mm-hmm.
whether it's bodhicitta, kindness,
mm-hmm.
creating good merit, and here all of these adds up, and eventually, you know, the self gets transformed. There's some goodness kind of arrives.
Mm-hmm.
But would you say that is the case with TSK, of keep challenging the self and its structure by, let's say, 5 times walking 1 hour the way we walk today?
Right.
What does that do to you?
Right.
Would you hold that, or do you intuitively say that would be the case?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's kind of a big question. It's a big question in Buddhism, too. You know, in some start with the Buddhist tradition, it just seems like an easier way to get into that question. So one of the distinctions or debates that is sometimes presented in the Buddhist tradition is between what they call the gradual path and the sudden path.
Mm-hmm.
So the gradual path is exactly that. You do, you know, you cultivate a certain form of understanding, a certain way of being, and little by little there is a quality of transformation. The sudden path says you don't have to do that, or maybe it says there's even something misleading about doing that, because the change that we're talking about is a transformation. It's a flip. It's a word that I've always liked, even though I don't really know the meaning in Sanskrit so well. Ashraya Parivarta, translated kind of as a turning around in the soul of your being. You know, used to be like this, and now it's like that. So there's that debate in the Buddhist tradition. Right? Mostly, and if you're in the Tibetan tradition, it said the gradual path. Do it gradually. Even though you can find other ways of presenting it, but still the fundamental notion is the gradual path. Now in TSK, maybe that emphasis has slipped around a little bit, I'm not quite sure. But both aspects are still there.
Mm-hmm.
So in TSK you say, you know, it's not that you have to do anything. It's not that, because there is nothing to undo. You know, it's the self has gotten hold, or the self insists, that's a better way to say it, the self insists on a certain way of being. And it insists that there's a reality that goes along with it. And one way to measure that reality, or to grasp it, or to see it in operation, is through the operation of time and space, which are very fundamental, and that's why Rinpoche winds up talking about time and space. And if those are transformed, then a new way of knowing becomes possible. The self insists on all of that, but it's only if you buy into what the self has claimed that any of that holds. If you see through the self, if you call the self into question, the self and its claims and assumptions and its way of structuring the world, which is what we've been looking at in this chapter, you know, it's this polarity between the subjective and the objective grows. So if you don't go along with that, then there's nothing that needs to be done. Now, you know, Buddhism will say something very similar. So the question always becomes, well, how do you make that switch? How do you turn around in that way? And the answer is, well, look, you know, you're very committed to this self of yours. And because you're so committed, you've got to undermine that commitment. You've got to find ways of doing that. And clearly, it's not conceptual. That's very clear from what's been said here, and we kind of know it, you know. And you know, you can say all sorts of things that are pretty interesting and even inspiring. It's just exactly what we've been talking about. And say reality is not what you think it is, and then, you know, people nod and then they go back to living exactly the same way, or not exactly the same way, but you know, kind of the same way. So then it kind of, you know, you say, well, you've got to work on that. You've got to you know, you're all the muscles are knotted up, and you've got to massage them and loosen them up until you relax.
Let me ask a really basic question. When you say self, right, do you mean the subjective conditioned self? Because you just threw out the word soul and this throwing out being. You know, self is used so a lot of different systems. Like
You're right. That's so true. And so a good working definition of self, I suppose, is the one that we insist is at the center of our experience.
Usual.
Yeah, the usual self. If you want to talk about, you know, there are traditions, for instance, which talk about self as a kind of a big capital S way, right? That's not a way that Rinpoche likes to talk about it. In the end, you would question that too, and there's in all the TSK writings, the place where he talks about that most directly, I think, is in chapter 29, The End of Knowledge, so you could go ahead and read that.
Maybe another way of asking that question, I'm not sure, but you keep saying you, but then you're also saying self.
Right.
Is there, are they different?
Okay.
No, I don't think they are. Maybe if I thought about it, I'd find some reason for wanting to say they are. But no, when I say you, I'm saying this self of yours that you insist on. What?
Well, at least as I'm listening to you, it seems like it's two different things. But because you say you, I can't remember one of your phrases, but it sounded like you acting on the self. And so that was my question. Is it yourself acting on yourself?
Okay. So I'm not sure if the word you is the most important part, or at least in what I understand, if the word you is the most important part. But there is a question, a very real question. Where I say, so you've got to do something about this self, something like that.
Right.
Yeah. So you say, so who's this you that's got to do something about this self, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one answer to that is to kind of hide behind language and say, well, that's just the way we have to talk about it, because the way our language operates. I don't think that's such a good answer. I think a better answer is to say that's the way we have to talk about it because of our commitment to the self. As long as we're committed to a self, nobody's going to get enlightened, nobody's going to get transformed, nobody's going to drop a commitment to the self other than the self. In the end, you look back and you say, well, that's not right at all. That's not the right description. That's not how it happened. But on this side of the divide, I'm sounding a little bit too Buddhist here, I'm sorry. But on this side of the divide, there is no useful way to talk about this that doesn't involve the self, you know, that doesn't involve a kind of commitment to the self as the one that's going to be called into question. You know, I don't feel completely satisfied with what I just said, but there's a point in a direction that seems possibly fruitful.
Yeah, no, I'm just still struggling with it, though. Obviously, you struggle with it a little bit too, but how to understand it, how to try to understand conceptually, which is going to be part of the problem.
That's part of the problem, yeah.
You know, I'll never listen to you, it was making sense. At some point, I was struck by it, okay, you know, that difference, and then if you were in it, is that part of even the conceptual problem, that how do you talk about something acting on itself?
Mm-hmm.
Could I throw in a third thing, though? Because I had that same question, and then there's that one sentence, I think at the end of the previous page, where there's something about knowing is separate from being, from your being. And so your being seems like a separate thing from you, which seems like a separate thing from yourself. In that context. So I was wondering whether the your being is the you that does the acting on the self.
Well, see, I don't think being, the way Rinpoche talks about it mostly, sometimes, you know, it's a loose word, so it probably gets used in different ways, but basically, the way he's talking about being is it's not my being, it's not your being, right? It's the way... I really want to say it's the way things are, but for me that's kind of a technical term, and I don't think the way things are is the way things are. We make a commitment to things being a certain way, and then we say that's the way things are. And that is this pre-existing world that we were talking about, right? But if you take the phrase the way things are, and you drop the idea that there's a way that things are,
right.
If you drop the way and you just say things are,
right.
and even then you drop the things and then you drop the are, but there's still something there that's being.
Similar language, I don't know who might use this, maybe even Rinpoche, because we're talking about like direct experience happens. So you sort of take away the, even in the language, you take away the subject, I, you, whatever, and that and language gets a little closer to it, as we're talking about some of the exercises we did, we're sort of hinting at, you know, instead of saying I'm experiencing something, direct experience of something happens that has some different kind of sense to it than going through this structure of self that, object stuff that we're talking about. So I don't know, maybe that kind of language, and again, it's part of the language that's about structure, that is part of what you're saying. It's hard to get it to talk about it, right? Which is part of the struggle.
Well, dropping the ownership of the one who's experiencing is being. If you drop the ownership of it in the knower, then that's what you have is the experience.
Yeah, there is something, you know, I mean, I think this sentence that we've focused on a little bit in our discussion this evening is, knowing loses its intimate connection to being, right? If you contact a different way of knowing,
I have a question.
Then you contact a different way of being. And just one more thing. So, you know, one of my other favorite phrases from this book is knowledge is not what the knower knows. Yeah, and that's very much in the sense of ownership. And because part of the operating assumption we have is that the self is the only one that can know. And it used to be in a different world, you know, centuries ago, for most people, that you would say, well, God can know. Right? But that's not an interesting issue for us anymore. Yeah. So, So now we only have the self we can know. And then that means there's only a certain kind of knowledge. So if you say knowledge is not what the knower knows, you allow for a different possibility, and a different kind of knowing can emerge, then with that comes a different way of being, and that's, you know, maybe an unexpected way of healing that split. Okay, sorry.
Okay.
Yes.
Even if we, you know, even if we're able to get in that second level time of being without the knower and the owner of the experience, there's still this model of knowing that we need to work on, that we go by. This model for knowing that he talks about, that we have to do something about.
Right. Yeah, there's you know, and you know that in various places in the books, Rinpoche will talk about three different levels.
Right.
You can say there's a second level at which we really can deconstruct the usual model of knowledge as being what the knower knows. And then you end up, maybe not end up, but then there's a certain kind of experience. And if it goes in the direction of any kind of model or identification or labeling, then you need to find a way to drop that
too. Structure too. That's, we got that far on the online class too.
We did
get that far.
For us, okay.
It was awesome. Right. We did. Don't you agree that we did?
I do. I agree.
You agree?
Oh, thank you. Good. Don't you agree that we did?
I don't remember.
Oh, yeah. You think we did?
Does that mean we can practice it?
No,
conceptually, we heard it.
We discussed it, or we heard it.
Oh, yeah. We did this. Well,
so there's a Zen story.
This is exciting.
I may not have it right. I'm not sure I have it quite right, but I think I do. about a Zen student who was carrying water, you know, the way they carry it on buckets on a pole. His teacher saw him and he called out to him and said, "What are you carrying?" He said, "I'm carrying these buckets of water." And he said, "Drop it." And so he dropped the buckets of water. And they just rolled away. And he said, "Now what are you carrying?" And he said, "Nothing." And he said, "Drop that too."
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of going in this direction.
That's Zen. Very Zen.
Okay. What I know, which is not very. Well, I do want us to do practice, so we were at the end of this paragraph, which is right before the next break, so we'll have to stop there and keep on with this. We were talking about the direct consequence of this pattern is that the impact of even the most powerful insights quickly fades. As we discover that the knowledge we attain seems incapable of transforming our being, we may lose confidence in the value of knowledge to affect our lives. We are left torn and frustrated, knowing that we know, and this is your point, Pamela, but witnesses to the inability of our knowledge to affect us at the most fundamental level.
And that's a very trapped place to be, and know it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can know it if you're awake, like you said, if you're awake to that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Very frustrating place.
And you know, one of the things I think that happens with TSK, which is not, you know, again with Buddhism too, but which is not so comfortable necessarily, is that you do wake up more and more.
And it's not comfortable when you're doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Because you get frustrated because you want to know how can we make things different. And it's like David and Goliath.
Yeah, right. But then you have to, you know, to go back to that image, then you have to drop the frustration too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so now, let's close the book.
Okay. Oh, this is a great class.
And we'll do a practice.
Great class.
So, and I suggest that this is a good sitting on a cushion practice. I have a very simple-minded approach. Whenever the instructions say, sit with your back straight, then I say, okay.
Very good. Mm. Yeah, agree. Mm.
You got one already, don't you, darling?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Here, who else needs one? Does anybody else need a pillow? There's one more left.
So we're going to do a practice which comes from the very end of the first TSK work. And it seems to fit well with what we've been discussing. It's called evocation of knowledge.
What?
Evocation of knowledge. So the instruction is to sit in a relaxed way with the back straight. Let yourself settle into your experience. And then to begin to, I think he uses the word visualize, but then he kind of takes it back. But it's not imagine, not imagine. It's to begin to have a sense of, let's say, an energy in the base, at the base of the skull. And it's a feeling, there's a feeling there. So just a feeling of a kind of an energy. And it might be warmth, it might be light, it doesn't, it's just energy. We want to keep it kind of open. And it's on the feeling level. And that energy then begins to move in a kind of column down the spine. And then to curve around and come up the front of the body. And you don't, you know, it doesn't have a color particularly. It's the feeling tone of the energy. And the quality of the energy is one of knowing. It has a knowing quality. So you say, what does it mean to have you know, a knowing energy? Mm-hmm. Don't worry about it. Just you know, allow for that possibility. So it's as though you say, as though we were saying, you know, we're going to just set aside this understanding that we've just been talking about of knowledge as based on concepts and models and ideas and all of that. And we're just going to evoke a knowledge that does have the power, a power that is at least equivalent, let's say, to the self and its desires. Right? It's not based on the self and its desires. It's a knowing that has an aliveness, and that's the energy. So it's an energy that flows down the spine and then curves back around and comes up the front of the body and basically just forms that oval, I guess, must be a nicer word than oval.
Does it happen fast?
You know, it's your call. Or maybe it's knowledge, knowing's call, not, you know, however it happens. Probably, I would think, in my experience, let me say, not so fast. Not so fast. And it may be that you know, you don't really get a sense of this now. That's okay, we'll do it again. And it's certainly the case that it doesn't have to be very precise.
Well, I'm already having a sense of it. It's really fast.
Okay. I'm not surprised somehow. Okay. It doesn't have to be very precise. It doesn't have to be anything. But that's the practice. Okay? An energy that flows down the spine, curves around, comes back up the front of the body, all the way across the top of the head, and back down to the base of the spine, and continues. That's the flow. So, okay, let's do it. do give yourself a chance to get into the just the feeling of sitting here on the cushion, probably before you start the practice. Thank you. around the room a little bit. Look at you in relation to everything else. So when I say look that second time, I don't mean with the eyes. Just sort of ask yourself, how do you stand in relation to everything else? Okay, we'll stop there tonight. If you like, when you're lying in bed tonight, you might try doing this circulation of energy. Maybe it's very different when you're all stretched out, you know.
It's very clear why you had us do those exercises you had us do.
Okay.
To open up those pathways.
Okay, good.
Right?
I'm glad that works for you. Good. Okay, let's stop for tonight. And tomorrow morning we will meet at 9:30. There's the Kumye. Kathleen, I changed my mind about trying to organize that Dharma publishing tour tomorrow, the tour to the press. I think let's try to do it on Thursday instead, but there's a lot of free time anyway.
Okay.
And,
okay.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay. Sleep well.
Yeah. Well, or something.